83. The King of Stool Pigeons. In the rare moments when he was not preoccupied with the struggle for existence, truckling to his masters or trying to work, Artur Siromacha, no longer as tense and wary as a leopard, was seen to be a rather languid young man. He had the build of an athlete, but his face was that of an actor jaded by too many performances, and his vague blue-grey eyes seemed clouded by sadness. Two quick-tempered men had called Siromacha a stoolie to his face, and both were speedily transported. Since then, nobody had repeated the word in his hearing. People were afraid of him. A prisoner was never confronted with the stoolie who had denounced him. He would never know whether he was accused of planning to escape, to commit a terrorist act, or to join a mutiny. He would simply be told to collect his belongings, and whisked off to a camp, or perhaps to a high-security jail for interrogation. Tyrants and jailers use their knowledge of human nature skillfully. As long as a man is capable of unmasking traitors, inciting a crowd to revolt, or sacrificing his life to save others, hope is not yet dead in him. He still believes that all may yet be well, still clings to the pathetic shreds of happiness left to him, and so is silent and submissive. But once he is shackled and prostrate, has nothing left to lose, and so is capable of heroism, only the stone box of an isolation cell will feel the force of his belated fury, unless the chill breath of a death sentence renders him indifferent to all earthly things. Siromacha had not been publicly unmasked or caught in the act, but no one doubted that he was a stoolie. Some avoided him. Others thought it safer to be friendly, to join with him in a game of volleyball and smutty talk. That was how they got along with other stoolies, too. So life in the Sharashka looked peaceful enough, but beneath the surface, war to the death was raging. Artur could talk about other things besides women. The Foresight Saga was one of his favourite books, and he discussed it quite intelligently, though Galsworthy shared his favours with a bunch of well-thumbed detective stories. Artur also had an ear for music. He was fond of Spanish and Italian airs. He could whistle snatches of Verdi and Rossini in tune, and he had gone once a year to a concert in the conservatoire, feeling that life would be incomplete without it. The Siromachas were gentry, impoverished gentry. At the beginning of the century, one Siromacha had been a composer, another sentenced to forced labour for a serious crime, while yet another had declared enthusiastically for the revolution and served in the Cheka. When Artur came of age, he had felt that an assured independent income was essential to someone of his tastes and needs, an uneventful stick-in-the-mud existence, a daily grind from XAM to YPM, and a twice-monthly pay envelope subject to heavy deductions for tax and state loan subscriptions did not appeal to him at all. When he went to the movies, he quite seriously sized up all the famous female stars as potential partners. He could easily imagine himself making a dash for Argentina with Diana Durbin. A university education was obviously not the route to such a life. Artur put out feelers for a job in which he could flit lightly from flower to flower, and a job of the right kind was looking for him. They met. The job did not pay as well as he could have wished, but it exempted him from the draft during the war and so saved his life. While fools out there were mouldering in clay trenches, Artur, smooth-cheeked, creamy-complexioned, grave-faced Artur, was strolling nonchalantly into the Savoy restaurant. Ugh, that moment when you cross the threshold of a restaurant and the cooking smells and the music lap around you while you select your table. Artur's whole being sang that he was on the way up. People who regarded his employment as ignoble aroused his indignation. He put it down to ignorance or envy. His was a job for the talented. It demanded powers of observation, a good memory, quick wits, and the ability to dissemble, to act a part. It was work for an artist. It had to be hush-hush, of course. Without secrecy, it would cease to exist. But secrecy was essential for purely technical reasons, like, say, the protective visor needed by an electric welder. Otherwise, Artur would not have dreamed of keeping his work secret. There was nothing morally reprehensible about it. One day, finding that he was living beyond his means, Artur had joined a coterie with designs on state property. He was jailed. Artur was not the man to take it amiss. He blamed himself for getting caught. From his very first days there, Artur naturally felt that his sojourn behind barbed wire was merely a continuation of his old occupation in a different form. The security services did not let him down. He was not sent logging or down a mine, but given a job in the cultural and educational section. This was the only place in the camp with a little light, the one cozy corner where you could look in for half an hour before lights out and feel human again. Scan a newspaper, hold a guitar, remind yourself of verses you once knew, or the incredible life you once led. The camp's Dili Tomatoviches, the hardened criminal's name for incorrigible intellectuals, frequented the place, and Artur, with his artist's soul, his sympathetic eyes, his Moscow memories, and his talent for skimming the surface of any subject whatsoever, was very much at home there. He lost no time in reporting a number of individual agitators, a group with anti-Soviet attitudes, two escape attempts not yet at the planning stage, but, he said, contemplated, and the camp's very own version of the doctor's plot. Medical saboteurs were deliberately prolonging the treatment of patients, in other words, letting them rest up in the hospital. All these sitting ducks had their sentences prolonged, whereas Artur's was reduced by 2 years. In Marfino, Artur did not neglect the profession that had served him so well. He became the pet, the soulmate of both Godfather Majors, and the most dangerous informer in the Institute. But while taking advantage of his denunciations, the Majors did not share their own secrets with him. So Saramaka did not know which of the two had used Doranin as an informer, and was most in need of up-to-date news of him. Much has been written about the astounding ingratitude and disloyalty of humanity at large. But there are exceptions. With reckless prodigality, Rusko Doranin had confided his double-agent scheme not to just one Zek, not just to three, but to 20 or more. Each of them had told several others. Doronin's secret became the property of nearly half the Institute's inhabitants, and people talked about it almost openly in their living quarters. Yet not a single stoolie, and there was one to every 5 or 6 men in the Sharashka, had heard anything, or at any rate no one had reported it. The most observant, the keenest-scented of them, Arch-Stoolie Artur Siramacha, had himself heard nothing until today. He felt now that his honour as an informant was at stake. The godfathers, sitting in their offices, might miss a trick, but that he should... He was in imminent danger of inclusion in the transfer list, just like the others. Doranin had proved to be a nimble foe. Saramaka must hit back just as swiftly. He had not yet realised the scale of the disaster. He thought that Doranin had shown his hand only that day or the day before. But Saramaka could not go bursting into people's offices. He must not lose his head and pound Shikin's door, or even hurry up to it too frequently. Those lining up to see Mushin were turned away when the 3 o'clock bell rang. The most importunate Zeks argued with the man on duty in the staff hallway, and Saramaka, clutching his belly as if in pain, approached the medical orderly and stood waiting for the group to disperse. Dersin was called into Mushin's office. Saramaka assumed that there was nothing to keep him there, but the interview seemed never-ending. Risking Mamurin's displeasure, he had missed an hour's work in Number 7, where the air was thick with the fumes of soldering irons, rosin, and plan talk. Saramaka waited for Mushin to dismiss Dersin. Waited in vain. He must not give the game away, even to the rank-and-file guards gawking at him in the hallway. Losing patience, he went upstairs to Shikin's office, returned to Mushin's hallway, then back upstairs again. At his last attempt, he was luckier. From the dark lobby outside Shikin's office, he heard the unmistakable rasping voice of the yardman through the door. No one else in the Sharashka spoke like that. He immediately gave the secret knock. The door opened slightly, and Shikin appeared in the aperture. "It's very urgent," Saramaka whispered. Just a minute, Shekin answered. Saramaka walked briskly toward the far end of the hallway, in order to avoid the yardman when he emerged, then hurried back and barged into Shekin's room without knocking.